Welcome to the Repair Ed podcast, where we reflect on education and reimagine equitable futures. I'm Claire Neves, a researcher who worked in education in the city of Bristol in the southwest of England for over 15 years. In each episode, I'll talk to educators and thinkers about current injustices in our schooling system and their ideas for creating fairer educational futures. This podcast forms part of Repair Ed, a five-year project funded by UKRI to examine educational inequality in Bristol's primary schools. Welcome to another episode of the Repair Ed podcast. My guest today is Kezia Featherstone, executive head teacher, co-founder of Women Ed and co-chair of Head Teachers Roundtable. She has extensive experience as a teacher and leader in Bristol and the West Midlands and has had the dubious pleasure of having been my head teacher when I worked as a special educational needs coordinator. In today's episode, there are a number of phrases and acronyms that might not be immediately clear if you haven't worked in education. I'll explain these before we start, so feel free to skip forward a couple of minutes if you're familiar with the language used in schools. Kezia mentions a bulge coming through. This is how we describe an increase in the birth rate in a particular year or period of years, meaning that more school places will be needed. EBAC percentage. This is the percentage of Year 11 pupils who gain a set of GCSE qualifications called the English Baccalaureate. English, Maths, Science, a language, and either History or Geography. Progress 8. This is an accountability measure for schools which shows the progress made by pupils between the end of primary school and the end of secondary school. The higher a pupil's Progress 8 score, the more progress they have made in comparison with pupils who started at a similar level. A school score above zero means pupils in that school make better than average progress. It's called Progress 8 because it's calculated using 8 qualifications in specific groups. Download day is the day that schools get GCSE results, the day before they are given to pupils. I mention organised abandonment. For more on this, read Ruth Wilson Gilmore's work on the US prison system. EdExcel and AQA English refer to two of the main exam boards. Kezia talks about finding time within 1265. This is the 1,265 hours per academic year that teachers can be directed for. Teachers work many more hours than this, but these are the ones which are directed by head teachers, so face-to-face with pupils, staff meetings, parents' evenings, and so on. ITT is initial teacher training. URN stands for Unique Reference Number, which is the school code. All pupils have a UPN, a unique pupil number, which identifies them as they go through their education. SEND stands for Special Educational Needs and Disabilities and is often simply called SEND. Morning, Kezia. Can you tell us a bit more about yourself?
Thank you ever so much, Claire. It's lovely to see you again. Brilliant to see you flourish in all sorts of different ways, so that's wonderful. About me, I am my mid-50s now, which is kind of scary. I've been in education for 30 years, which is even scarier. In that time, I've seen some things improve, a lot of things not improve. I've seen, particularly for children from under-resourced backgrounds, things getting worse, particularly post-COVID. I think that has absolutely ravaged them. I've seen, I suppose, awareness grow of underrepresented groups within education, but not an awful lot being done to improve that. And weirdly, I'd include women in that because we are the majority and yet we are still marginalised, particularly in leadership. So I think last week I saw something that the gender pay gap in primary schools, particularly for head teachers, had widened, which is absolutely astounding. It what the heck are we doing? We know that over 92% of head teachers in the country identify as white British. Again, what the heck are we doing? It just doesn't seem to be changing, not very fast. I think there's a lot of people talking about it, not a lot of people trying to change it.
Absolutely. And I think our project, we're focusing on these conversations. So I guess that could be levelled at us, lots of people talking about it. But what we're doing is trying to talk to a wider view of people, but also the people who really matter in this. So a lot of our research is talking directly to people in schools and people in communities that disadvantage really affects. So our project, Repair Ed, focuses on educational inequality in the city of Bristol. And you obviously worked here in the city for quite a while. So what are your reflections around Bristol as a city?
I didn't enjoy it. I really couldn't settle to the city. And obviously, now I'm no longer there. So it was a 4-year experiment for us. It was intended to be permanent. I wanted to be closer to my family, who mum and dad are down in Somerset. That was the intention. But the actual city itself is a weird one. I mean, I'd spent the first however many years of my career in the West Midlands, which does have, you know, it's a very multicultural city. It has pockets of huge deprivation, and then it has real affluence in some particular areas. Really culturally diverse, very, very different. Coming down to Bristol, first of all, my gut feeling was it was really quite white, and that is a comparison to living in Birmingham. And then I suppose the social inequality was so fundamentally entrenched that it was like educational apartheid. It was talking to the heads in one half of the city was completely different to the heads in the other half of the city. And I up until that point, and since I've been back in the West Midlands, you find that a lot of people are sort of maybe not be in your school or in your trust or in your local authority, but generally speaking, it's a collaborative spirit. Everyone's facing very similar challenges, demands. There are accountability measures that compete us against each other. And in some areas that I've worked, everyone's like, you know, oh, I see you're third in the table this week, or I'm bottom again, or whatever it is. In Bristol, that wasn't it. That was like the be-all and the end-all. Where are we all in this league table of success? And, you know, it was the metaphorical stabbing in the back was appalling. The way some of the, not just the heads, I suppose the staff as well, and to some extent sort of the parents behaved, it was shocking. The competitive nature of it. And I just couldn't settle to it. It was deeply upsetting for me. And I properly invested emotionally and time and commitment. As you know, my daughter attended the school. All her mates came from the school, lived in the area that we were trying to work with. Maybe they've all improved. But particularly the other side of the river, it was, you know, selecting their student intakes either through religion or through gender or through compliance or through all sorts of other different measures, because they wanted the high quality students, and I hate that phrase, but it was being bandied around at the time, at the detriment of everybody else. They just didn't care. It was really unpleasant, and that's my overriding feeling about it. You know, even sort of 7-8 years later, having left, my overriding feeling is it was not a nice place to work. The city did not live up to its values. And it's got a particular perspective, you know, it presents itself in a particular way, but certainly in terms of education, it absolutely never lived up to those values.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I was talking to someone from Brighton in one of our episodes, and he talked about the reputation of Brighton as this, you know, liberal, inclusive city. And yet when it comes down to it, people are just really invested in their own little pockets of the city and their own children. And I said that really resonated with me, thinking about Bristol and how loudly Bristol sort of proclaims to be a really diverse, inclusive city. And yet actually, when you get into things, it's not there so much. And the other thing that came into my mind while you were talking is, in our research, we've found lots of teachers, particularly young teachers, are talking about issues that they're facing, really difficult issues, like having to buy resources themselves, having to feed children who don't have enough to eat, having to support with school uniform, etc. But something that they're saying, which I find really confusing, is that they're saying, oh, I don't think this had happened in other schools. And these are really widespread problems. So the point that you're saying about the competition between schools, I think perhaps contributes to that feeling of isolation by teachers. If they're in a school that's sort of desperate to do the right thing for its own pupils and not seeing where it fits into that Bristol context. And of course, Bristol is so heavily academised, lots of independent schools. It's a really complex picture here. So it's really difficult to get any sense of Bristol as a city working together, which I think is what you felt.
It's really fractured and not in a good way. I mean, I don't know how you can be fractured in a good way, but it pits people against each other, and I would argue, particularly if you are struggling with student numbers, and particularly when I was there, they kept talking about this bulge coming through. I don't know if it ever materialised, but certainly schools were struggling for numbers, and if you're struggling for numbers, you want to be full, and you are also struggling against external accountability measures, which I think are horrendous. You know, what is your EBAC percentage? What is your progress A? And it's like, actually, for a lot of the schools, this is not the curriculum that suits the children. You are straitjacketing them. And if you're a head teacher that makes the decision that I'm not going to play the EBAC game, this doesn't suit our children, or not all of them anyway, you're penalised in terms of the accountability measures. And I remember the Bristol Post were just rabid to know what the results were so they could put us in a league table. You know, they were on the phone on download day. They wanted to know. And, you know, you will remember sort of the summer before I joined, the billboard fiasco, where one of the schools took out a billboard and put everybody's results up. They were unvalidated results. And they put theirs up that were like the best case scenario if all the appeals came through. And they had that up for 2 months while year six parents were making selections. I mean, I tell people that and they don't believe me. I mean, I didn't believe it. They're sitting in my roundabout the first September I'm there going, what the heck is that? And I know that one particular school, but I went to another school for a meeting. They'd done the same, but with like posters on reception. So every parent that came in to have a tour of the school, they knew exactly what the ranking of the South Bristol schools were. And it perpetuated this idea that school is rubbish because the results are rubbish and therefore the kids are rubbish. And I remember the CEO at the time doing some market research, paid a company quite a lot of money to go and get some perceptions of the school and the children from people that lived in the local area. And we couldn't share it with the staff or the community. And actually, we didn't share a lot of it with the governors because it was horrendous. And I'm thinking, do you know what? You live three streets away. You know, these are our children, and this is the way you're talking about them. And therefore, because of those children, you don't want to send your children there because somehow the perception you have of these young people is that it's contagious to your child. It was probably, I mean, I had to leave the meeting when we got the feedback, and I went and had a little cry. And I don't really do crying, you know, it's not me, but I couldn't believe that human beings would talk about children that way. And of course, you know, some of the children were as young as five, and that, you know, they were just being written off. How can a city that is, you know, presents itself as, you know, this wonderful cultural magnet and the Banksy and the artsy and the rivers and all that kind of stuff, essentially, and I don't know where sort of the slave trade builds into this, but it is that idea that we have the power and the wealth, and you are scum, and you are not human. And that mindset, to some extent, might have changed from race to class, but I think it was probably always there, and I think it's still there. And there was just something really embedded in the collective unconscious of the city that has to stratify everything into the I am here, and the people I don't like and don't want to mix with are almost subhuman, and I can do with them and talk about them however I want. And the outcome of that is the people that are in that demographic know that's how everybody else feels about them, and you know, I suppose they kind of play up to it and they hunker down and they become quite isolated and they don't seek help and support. And they're really resentful of anybody that wants to come in and support them, because you know, that feels as if, you know, it's just perpetuating the views you have of us. I don't know what you need to do to get out of it, but it's not going to be a fast fix. And you know, and I was all in.
Yeah.
But those measures, they got in the way. And I probably won't say anything that would get myself in trouble.
Thank you for sharing that. I think really powerful reflections, and absolutely reflecting what we're finding on the project when we talk to people about areas of the city like Hartcliffe, like Philwood and Knowle West. We really, really hear that sense that the rest of the city has this view without even having been there. And I think it's absolutely right to pick up on, especially as our project is working in primary schools, these are young, really young children we're talking about, and how can these young children have any sort of responsibility, or, you know, how can you characterise children in that way? And when you unpick the history of these areas, one of the things we're working with at the moment is seeing whether we can apply the abolitionist concept of organised abandonment to these areas where they have been deliberately and systematically underfunded for so many years, and that has a huge impact. And one of our community knowledge holders in one of our areas, it echoed exactly what you said about the estate almost perpetuating the view that others have of them to keep others out. So you find these really, really tight-knit communities, really close communities who really do support each other. But there's this, I like to call it this mythology of place around some of these places. I know when I applied for my job in Hartcliffe many, many years ago, people in other cities said to me, oh, don't go to Hartcliffe. And I said, have you ever been? They said, no, but and we get that sense, you know, even in Bristol, which is geographically fairly small, isn't it? So, you know, there's no real excuse for having these views about places that you haven't been to in such a small city. But you're absolutely right that it's so different to how the city likes to view itself.
And I think that place is important, because I can't believe that the city planners didn't do it on purpose. You've got these, you know, the social housing belt, and there's a massive dual carriageway ring road that separates it from the rest of the city.
Mm.
You know, it's literally like a fracture throughout, you know, and it holds them back. And then behind it, you just got hills. You know, it's and you've got some beautiful views there. I mean,
absolutely.
In any other place, you'd be building beautiful properties there, and it's bonkers. And I did, you know, however long ago it was that I went down, 10, 12 years or so, I did my due diligence. I talked, and you know, I know people that are in politics in South Bristol, talked to some councillors, talked to sort of the office manager for the local MP. I think he's still the office manager for the new MP down there, and I found out about this community, and it's small, and you know, from my office window, I could see the Clifton Suspension Bridge, and I could see some of the houses that are up on the hill there, that side. And, you know, we were thinking, what if I lived over there, if I lived in the posh bit of town and my kids were struggling close to the exams, what would I do? Well, I'd get a tutor. Well, tutors are quite expensive, so let's pay for year 11s to be tutored. So we phoned up some companies, and they're like, oh yeah, we can support you with that. We can do it at scale. We're happy to come into school and do it. We're happy to go to their houses. You know, where are you? And we told them where we were, and they said, no, we don't visit those postcodes. Mm. And we ended up going through a few companies that just refused to come to the other side of the city. And then we did get one, and they were bloody rubbish.
Mm.
They, you know, they didn't like our kids. They didn't believe, you know, the kids were saying, oh, but we're doing EdExcel English. And they're like, no, I'm going to teach you AQA because you must be wrong. And it was just like everything stacked against them educationally. Absolutely everything. And they become quite isolated. And I suppose that is, they don't have much exposure to different people. They don't, you know, they don't necessarily have that direct experience dealing with people that come from different socioeconomic groups, come from different political mindsets, come from different ethnic backgrounds. I suppose that was a protective thing. I mean, you can say that it doesn't engender like a good positive worldview, and it perpetuates the situation they're in. But it's really protective. You know, you're not open to being ridiculed. Mm-hmm. And I suppose in the West Midlands, there are instances of that. But I think collectively everybody's shocked. So, sort of one of our sick formers applied to go to the University of Birmingham, wanted to do medicine, had to go in for an interview, was sitting in a waiting room with some other students, and obviously they're all talking, and because he's got a regional accent, it's not quite Brummy, it's a bit more Peaky Blinders, I guess, and because when then he said what school he went to, the other kids in the waiting room laughed at him, and he left. Because he was embarrassed, he didn't know what to do, and it took him a little while. And the minute we found out, we phoned up the university, and they wanted his name, the date, they rescheduled the interview, and then they disapplied all the kids that had laughed at him.
Wow.
And that was powerful, that was a message. You do not ridicule somebody because of their socioeconomic background, and if you do, you are not living the values of our university, and we're not even going to contemplate you. I mean, I'm sure they got into somewhere else that was all very glamorous, but, you know, that it was just absolutely not. And I think there would have been no head teacher in any of the circles that I work in that, you know, would not have been horrified about that. But actually, the more challenging that community, the more that pretty much every school's in the same boat. Everybody's facing the same problems and everyone's really collaborative. Mm. And, you know, sort of, you know, WhatsApp groups of all the heads going, you know, oh my God, this has happened, what do I do? And supporting each other, not sticking results up on billboards.
Mm.
And it's like, nobody will share results with the local papers. Just not going to do it.
Right.
I'm not in competition with you. Obviously, when they come out validated, the papers will do it anyway. But by then, no one really gives a toss, and the parents will then forget it. And everyone thinks this is the way to judge schools.
Mm.
But it's not in so many areas. The way parents judge schools, it's not by Ofsted results, it's not by banners outside, it's not by percentages, it's by Facebook.
Mm.
It's about what their friends and colleagues and what they see on Facebook about those schools, and are they being recommended? And actually that, I think, is far more powerful. And actually, I was speaking to a researcher last week who said, actually, we're talking to a lot of parents and they don't use Ofsted reports. And I know the DfE keeps saying, but this is why we're using them. And it's like, no, they're not using them. They don't actually care that much. Every now and again they will, but actually they just want to know if their kid's going to be happy there and they're going to do okay. And isn't that what we all want for our kids?
Yeah, absolutely. You've said so much there, which is...
Sorry, I did bang on
a bit. No, not at all. It's really interesting, and you know, you're actually sort of preempting my questions. you know, around what things are like in the West Midlands and how similar or different it is. And it's interesting to hear, I suppose, that there are some of the same challenges, but far less competition. And that story about the pupil going to university, that took me back to a girl I taught in my very first class as a teacher, who was exceptionally bright and wanted to go on to sixth form. But of course, there wasn't a sixth form that she could go to in her area. And the sixth forms in the centre of Bristol, she said that she didn't want to go because if she went there, people would ask which school she went to, and then people wouldn't want to be friends with her. And I bumped into her a few years down the line, and she was working with a friend of mine, so she'd got herself a good job, you know, in a good company. But she hadn't been to further education and higher education, which she absolutely had the capacity in terms of academics to do so. And I think that perception of an area as somewhere where people don't go on to university, you know, don't mix in these circles, is so powerfully entrenched in these children. And it's, like you said, it's going to take a long, long time to shift things. I suppose one of the things I wanted to ask is in terms of shifting those things. So, you know, you're part of Women Ed and Head Teachers Roundtable, so you're very connected to the wider educational community. What's being done around educational inequality?
Probably not enough, or not enough fast enough to keep us happy.
Mm.
I think, you know, the new cabinet has opened this, you know, war on poverty sort of work group that, you know, you're looking at combining health and education and housing and everything else in order to look at the sort of the policies that can sort of affect change. I think even Labour have been shocked by how little money is there. There is absolutely no flex, and I think all the plans that they were putting into place, thinking, well, maybe, you know, maybe there's a little bit tucked away, it's not quite as rubbish as we thought it was, wouldn't come to fruition. But I think that, I mean, my gut tells me the combined effects of COVID with leaving Europe, and now particularly at a time when, you know, some of the other big countries are sort of not playing ball as much as perhaps we did economically, it's really difficult to find where the areas of growth are going to be. And I think supporting people and education to make a real difference is expensive. There's no way around it. It is resource heavy. It's resource heavy in terms of people and what you do with them. I'm not saying you give people money, you know, you don't go out with cash and just pass it around, but actually you need smaller class sizes. You need more adults that are really well trained. You need minibuses to get them around, because it's not just about cultural capital, it's about experiential capital, actually building up the experiences. We took some year sevens into Birmingham the other year, and some of them, I mean, obviously loads of them had never been on a train, some of them had never been into Birmingham, but they hadn't been on an escalator, and they were scared. And one of the girls held on to, like, a complete stranger that was trying to get on the escalator behind her, because she was so terrified. It's like, we need to build these experiences in for children. The only way that we can build the time for that, because quite often we can find the money and resources for it if we look carefully enough, but what we have to do, we have to find the time. We can't find the time in 1265, and we particularly can't find the time in 1265 and however many weeks a year it is, if everybody is trying to play the accountability measures game.
Mm.
You just got to scrap progress eight. You've just got to change that and about what successful schools look like and how they feel so that people, the unintended consequence of that entire game is that no one wants the kids that are going to really struggle to get there. They don't want to invite them in year seven, and they certainly don't want to keep them until year 11. So, you know, you've got all sorts of things like, oh, no, we don't have a special educational needs department, you need to go to that school down there. Or, no, if your kid's a little bit of a class clown, they're going to get into a lot of trouble and be in loads of detentions over there. Like, no, the uniform is going to cost you £250 just to set up, and we've got logo socks, okay? So there's all sorts of things you can do. And then as they go through their school career, it's like, well, we really don't think that you're going to be suitable for us. There's off role and there's all sorts of things. People are playing that game that exclude children who have the potential to do really well. So let's just get rid of that. Let's find a different way to measure schools. I don't like the idea of measuring and benchmarking, because what you're doing is like you're putting kids in a rank order. That's abhorrent. But as well as that, I think you need to make sure that schools that are really focused on inclusion are celebrated, and there's loads of things that you can do around that. You need to find as many routes in for as many people as possible that want to work in schools to work in schools. The fact that you've got to have a degree to become a qualified teacher, you know, there are those people that didn't have the opportunity when they were at school to progress and do A levels, then go to university. It's expensive, and quite a lot of times you hear about families that don't want to support. So we need to diversify the way that we get people into the classroom, redistribute the hours, think about how we, you know, reward people, celebrate the schools that do really, really well. There's just loads of things that we can do and that we should be doing, you know, in some of these areas that are really sort of isolated. We have to encourage people from more diverse backgrounds to go and work there, and therefore they have to feel safe working there, they have to feel included, and that comes from the leaders. And actually, if the leaders are chasing another 0.2 on the Progress 8 score, then they're not thinking about being inclusive. There's only so many things somebody can do. And I guess at the beginning we talked about, we keep talking about this and not an awful lot of changes, but I don't think there's as many people talking about it as we think there is. We exist in a sphere where this is, you know, 80% of our professional life. Like yesterday, I went in. Gave a talk to a trust, Women in Leadership Day, and I shared like some data about, you know, like the sort of the ethnic pipeline from ICT through to headship. I talked about the gender pay gap, and, you know, stuff that's been out in the sort of the world for 5 years or so, you know, that, you know, and longer, because Women Ed's 10 years old this year. They'd never seen it before. They didn't know it was that bad. So actually, the more we talk about it, they will then go and talk to other people, and we've just got to get the numbers up. We've got to play a numbers game. We've got to get people talking about it and then doing something about it. And there are things that we can do about it. So let's bloody just get on and do it. Now, if it takes you and me repeating ourselves for 10, 20 years, then let's just do it. You know, what do we lose?
And we will keep talking about these things. Let's talk a bit about that ITT to leadership pipeline that you mentioned. So, because in my head, when you talk about that, I'm picturing the graph that shows that teachers from racially minoritized backgrounds are overrepresented at the application stage of initial teacher training. They are sort of represented pretty well at the teacher training stage, and then as you go through increasing seniority, so classroom teacher, middle leader, senior leader, head teacher, it just goes down and down, and the only group that's kind of staying representative or then becoming overrepresented is white people. So, I mean, you've taught in Bristol and in the West Midlands, which are both really racially diverse areas. What impact does that lack of black and brown leadership have on pupils?
who's their role models? Who's their role models for being successful as leaders, for making a way in the world of education and being successful if there's no one that looks like you that is either in the classroom or leading the school? But there have been perceptions that certain demographics shouldn't be working in particular areas. And we've, I think, you know, people with privilege have probably perpetuated that. And I'm not just talking about like that ethnic pipeline. You will see that, you know, women do that as well, don't we? We're overrepresented in the general workforce. We're not represented in headship and leadership positions. It becomes harder for us. We see that with people from under-resourced backgrounds. So the class should be a protected characteristic. You see that with disability. All of these things where the traditional privilege people that make some of the decisions, they're just not making it easy. And I think there's a difference between fitting in and belonging. I'm happiest where I feel I belong. Not just fit in, I genuinely belong. And I think there are too many institutions, and it's backed up by the evidence, too many institutions that don't make people feel as if they belong there. And I suppose that ties to the imposter syndrome, that we talk about gender with it a lot, but I think imposter syndrome apparently affects all sorts of different people with different protected characteristics. But it's not a real thing. It's not a syndrome. It's not an illness. What it is being in a room where you don't feel welcome. So you feel like the imposter because everybody else is making you feel different. Which is why, you know, if you're a woman and you walk into a room and everybody else there of your level is a man, you know, then you do feel like an imposter because they're looking at you. I mean, they may not be thinking that you don't belong there, but you feel they must think I don't belong there. And it's exactly the same for the global majority that go on to initial teacher training. Very quickly they feel like the imposter, like the person that doesn't belong there, and therefore they drop out or they don't progress. And sometimes that is really latent and unconscious, and sometimes it is really, really deliberate. And it is institutionalised racism or Islamophobia or sexism or homophobia, and it still perpetuates in too many of our schools and too many of our institutions. And the only way really to properly change it, and it's not going to happen overnight, is you have to change the demographic of the trustees or the local governing body, because they appoint the head teacher. The head teacher appoints everybody else. So if you've got a board that's mostly white, it's a voluntary position, so they tend to be, you know, people that maybe have retired, or they're not working parents, something like they've got some time to kill, or that you know they're really interested in it, but they tend to appoint people that look like them. They judge them by their standards. So it's about how they speak, or about their accent, or about their idiom, the words that they choose. Do they fit in? Do they, you know, they're choosing someone that fits in, even if that person has to sort of, you know, look a little bit uncomfortable. Are they going to think and behave like us? And if you can change what trustee boards and LGBs look like, you're changing how they think, how they behave. They're appointing different people. And that won't happen overnight, but there's not enough focus on it. And the more I sort of go through this, I just keep thinking about it. You know, there are trusts where nearly everyone appointed looks like a cardboard cutout of a rugby player. And that's because the CEO is a 60-year-old ex-rugby player, and all the heads look like him, and I suspect at interview they made some rugby jokes. You know, it's about cloning, isn't it? It's about what we expect leaders to be like, and how we expect them to behave and how we expect them to talk. And we relate to people that are most like us. Unless you're happy being really uncomfortable and taking a risk. And I think, you know, we take risks. And sometimes they pay off and sometimes they don't. But, you know, you've still got to do it.
Thinking about institutions, you know, we talk a lot about things like institutional racism and other forms of institutional inequality. But I guess what you've brought me back to is institutions are run by people, and we need to get the right people running those institutions, because they're not, those institutions aren't actors in and of themselves. They're made up of people. So that's a really, really important point to think about. It's easy for me as someone who's been in a lot of schools to see, but maybe just to point out to our listeners that a lot of those things, that those feelings of discomfort, of not belonging, of feeling like the way in which you're measured doesn't work for you, that all filters down to children as well. So when we're talking about, you know, working class children or black and brown children, that is all, you know, they're going to school in a system which perhaps isn't designed with them in mind, and that really has an impact. So I think we'll move on to our last question now, which is the same for all guests on our podcast. What would a just education system look like to you?
It's something that relentlessly supports the development of each individual child to be the very best they can be. And I genuinely think you could probably measure it as well, because I think if you take, every kid's got a URN, haven't they? They, you know, that translates into a national insurance number. I mean, it could be the same thing, couldn't it? You know, I mean, I don't like the idea of barcoding kids when they're born. But there is a way of tracking kids from the start to where they end up. How are children doing at 25? And we talk about that in SEND a lot, don't we? In terms of preparedness for adulthood. You know, the sort of up to 25 for children with special educational needs, adults with educational needs. But for every young person, what they're doing at 25, because they could have the best GCSE and A-level results in the world, they could have gone to university, crashed out, and now they're living in their mum's bedsit playing Xbox all day. And another child may have ended up with fairly rubbish GCSEs, gone and got an apprenticeship, but now it looks like he's on her way to owning the business that they are working in. You know, how do we measure success? And I think happiness and contribution to society and engagement with the world around you at 25 gives you a really good idea about how the school prepared you for life. And we all say we're preparing kids for life, but we stop thinking about them at 16 or 18 or 11. And if someone wanted to hold me accountable for how the children I've worked with are doing at 25, I'm fine with that. I'm just a part of their journey, but I want to really ensure that what they get with me is the very best and highest quality that they deserve. I don't know if that answers it, really.
Oh, I think it does. It's a really nice reminder that education, you know, and schooling has a really big impact on people's lives, but it's really important to remember that it's not the done deal. You know, there are those, like you said, who weren't particularly successful at school who go on to be hugely successful, and vice versa. And I think, you know, you picked up earlier on in this talk about the really narrow accountability measures that schools in this country are under. And, you know, if we're judging success by those, then we're taking a snapshot. And actually, you know, people's lives take varied courses. And yeah, education's so important, but there are wider things as well. And what's come through so much today is how much you've mentioned people feeling represented and people feeling comfortable. And so I think that's something else that I'd pick out of your answer. You know, a just education system is one where all children and, you know, in fact, all staff feel comfortable and feel like they belong. And I think that's probably a really nice place to end the conversation. So thank you so much for speaking to me today.
No, thank you for inviting me. It's a privilege as ever to see you and to chat about things that really matter.
Thank you for listening to the Repair Ed podcast. Please take a listen to our other episodes, and if you'd like to be a guest, get in touch. Our email can be found on our website, www.repair-ed.uk.